This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, June 11th, 2020. In just a few minutes on Ozarks, we conclude our three-part series on Arkansas prisons and coronavirus. Today, Anna Stitt reports on what's next for Arkansas prisons. There are nearly 500 new cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas, with the largest number of cases in Springdale. At today's press briefing, Governor Asa Hutchinson announced Washington and Benton counties continue to have the most new cases, 143 and 78 respectively, in the last monitoring period. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says 93% of Washington County cases are in Springdale. There were an additional 6 deaths in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, bringing the state's total of fatal cases of the virus to 171. The governor says he's had discussions with business and medical leaders in Northwest Arkansas.
It's a plan for the return to on-site instruction in August. And we believe that this is an achievable goal, especially if plans allow flexibility for learning options in case interruptions occur. Arkansas Ready for Learning is also support for school districts as they prepare for the start of the new school year and return to on-site instruction in a manner that's consistent with guidelines.
Dr. Smith says a large number of cases in Washington County are among Latinx residents. He says there is spread within households, neighborhoods, and workplaces.
The CDC team will be arriving tomorrow. Their goal is to help us to better understand the dynamics of transmission in the northwest part of the state, particularly in Washington and Benton counties, helping to understand this interplay between transmission in the home, in the community, and in the workplace. And we are hoping that those insights will better enable us to break those cycles of transmission. They will also be helping us to more effectively learn how to better, more effectively reach out to our Latino community with messages that will help them to protect themselves and others from COVID-19 and to interrupt those chains of transmission.
Carroll County recorded a dozen new cases in the last period, and Pope County, 10 new cases. Part of the briefing today was also devoted to the next school year. Ivy Pfeiffer, Deputy Commissioner at the State's Department of Education, says the plan for August, called Arkansas Ready for Learning, is to focus on in-person, on-site learning with contingencies to pivot if needed.
I wanted to assure that we've checked the hospital capacity in Northwest Arkansas. It is sufficient. We'll continue to watch that. And also the PPE, they have adequate PPE as well, and so they're prepared to deal with this uptick that they have, but we'll continue to watch it to make sure that they have the supplies and support that they need.
The governor says the state's school year plan is a work in progress that will be updated throughout the summer. The full briefing can be found at the governor's YouTube channel, and you can stay up to date at the COVID-19 page at KUAF.com. and through our morning newscast with Antoinette Grajeda at 5:30 and 7:30 each weekday morning. Northwest Arkansas healthcare providers are launching a public service campaign to help increase awareness of the threat of COVID-19 in the region. A press release this afternoon indicates the campaign will include a regional-centric video that can be shared on many platforms, as well as public service announcements featuring local officials. Materials will be in Spanish and English. The press release denotes area hospitals are currently prepared, but if the spread continues at its current rate, health systems could become strained. This is Ozarks at Large. Inmates in 4 Arkansas state prisons have now tested positive for COVID-19. The virus first appeared at the Cummins unit and quickly became one of the country's largest known prison outbreaks. In the final part of a series supported by the National Geographic Society, reporter Anna Stitt looks at the Arkansas prison system's past and future in light of the virus.
Well, I have a vivid memory of the pulling up to the Cummins unit.
This is Kaleem Nazim. He was convicted as a juvenile and spent 27 years in Arkansas prisons. About 12 of those years were at the Cummins unit. It's the state's oldest and largest prison, built in 1902. It's named after one of the slave plantations that was there before.
And when I was like 9 or 10 years old, I used to always say to myself that, you know, how did, you know, people go for slavery? You know, I would have rebelled, I would have did this and I would have did that. On my way to the commons unit, we was just driving along these corridors of just fields, forest that I can see. And all these fields, you know, was planted with cotton.
Nazim says as he approached the prison that late summer day in the early 1990s, he started seeing shapes dotting the fields.
As you got closer, you recognized that there was people out in these fields picking cotton. Not only was they just picking cotton, it was like behind them you had riders on horses with big shotguns, you know, kind of just like pushing them up the field. And in that moment, I kind of, you know, said to myself, damn, you know, they got me.
The Cummins Unit is where folklorists Ruby and John Lomax recorded this song by prisoners in 1939. Human skeletons were found buried there in 1968. In the 1980s and 90s, the prison made international news for selling HIV and hepatitis-infected blood to hospital patients in multiple countries. It doesn't have the state's death row. That's at the Varner Unit Supermax a few miles away. But it does have the death chamber. So in 2017, it was where the state executed 4 men in 1 week, a record in the modern history of the U.S. death penalty. And over the last few years, multiple outlets have reported on clusters of deaths from the synthetic drug K2 across Arkansas state prisons, including at Cummins. The prison held about 100 more inmates than it had space for throughout the month of April. On April 13th, as virus numbers at the Cummins unit were starting to grow, a reporter asked Governor Hutchinson about the possibility of releases to make more space for social distancing.
There's some who would like to see the governor use his pardon and commutation powers to thin the ranks of inmates.
Well, this is probably an example of where that would be unwise. If you look at the, there's a reason that these inmates are in a maximum security unit. And so I don't see that happening.
The next week, groups including the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the American Civil Liberties Union banded together to sue the Arkansas Department of Corrections on behalf of prisoners. Among other things, they asked the department to regularly sanitize with cleaners known to be effective against COVID-19 and to release the most medically vulnerable people. A judge denied their request for temporary relief last month, saying there wasn't enough evidence that the Department of Corrections was mishandling COVID. At the end of April, the Board of Corrections did approve a list of more than 1,200 prisoners who were already eligible for parole in 6 months or less and who had no serious crimes against people on their record. So far, the state says it's released about half of those. The Department of Health assumes prisoners have recovered from COVID-19 14 days after they test positive for it. Based on that, they say almost everyone at the Cummins unit has now recovered. But the virus has spread beyond Cummins. About 42% of the prisoners at the Randall Williams unit in Pine Bluff have tested positive for COVID-19, and at least one person incarcerated there has died from the disease. At least 29 prisoners have tested positive for COVID at the East Arkansas Regional Unit in Brickies, and at least one has tested positive at the Grimes Unit in Newport. At the Varner Unit near Cummins, at least 2 staff have tested positive. A prisoner at Varner, Kenny Halfacre, died in his barrack there on May 26th. The coroner's report says he was struggling to breathe right before he died. Department of Health Secretary Dr. Nate Smith says anyone in a barrack with a COVID-positive person will be tested. We asked if Halfacre would be tested post-mortem. Dr. Smith said that would be up to a doctor from WellPath, the company contracted to provide medical services in Arkansas's prisons. An inmate inside Halfacre's barrack says he and multiple others have experienced symptoms and requested tests since the death, and they've been denied. The lawsuit filed on behalf of prisoners is still moving through the courts. The Department of Corrections filed a motion to block prisoners' attorneys from gaining access to evidence like security footage, prisoner grievances and disciplinaries, and who's been housed where and when inside state prisons. The judge did not approve it, so attorneys say they're gathering more evidence now. They hope the case can still impact how the department addresses COVID in other state prisons, but the timeline on it isn't clear. In the meantime, families protested outside the governor's mansion on May 16th.
And they all tested positive. What they supposed to do?
Again.
And last week, a coalition of people directly impacted by the prison system gave a list of demands to the governor.
So today, I stand here reading to you the list of demands we have for Governor Hutchinson.
The list includes permanently eliminating medical copays, eliminating the cost of calling family while visits are banned, and releasing prisoners at high risk of dying from COVID-19 to complete their sentence through in-home confinement. They say the state's response has been dangerous. But Governor Hutchinson and Department of Health Secretary Dr. Smith have both praised Arkansas's response to COVID-19 inside the state's prisons.
Thank goodness, you know, Cummins is the one that we've had the largest outbreak in, and I think we've addressed it very aggressively there.
I think working together with the WellPath people and Department of Corrections, they understand the need to have a higher index of suspicion and to do that initial testing more quickly so that we can respond more quickly. In terms of what we did after we were aware of the first case, I would really put that up against any other health department in the country.
Cecilia Tate was raising a daughter with Derek Coley, who was locked in isolation with COVID-19 up until the night he died last month. She says she doesn't see anything to praise about the state's response to COVID-19.
Maybe they don't care because they're criminals, but they got family out here that love them. They should think about if it was their sons in there. They won't want nobody to treat them like that. If they don't want to take care of them, Chloe comes down.
Khalim Nazim was released a year and a half before COVID-19 hit. But after 27 years inside, he's still in touch with a lot of incarcerated people. And he says the abuses of the past don't feel far away.
It's not hard to see the way history is literally repeating itself. When they had a pauper field at Cummins in the 70s and in the 50s, when they had doing the convict leasing thing, it was bodies buried in the field that everybody turned their eyes to. Well, today, during the COVID-19 epidemic, we have bodies, you know what I'm saying, that's buried within inside the walls of these prisons.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Anna Stitt.
That was the conclusion of a special series on COVID-19 inside Arkansas's prison system, supported by the National Geographic Society. You can find the first two reports at ozarksatlarge.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on our show, Arkansas's economy has suffered because of the past 13 weeks, but not as much as the states that border Arkansas. On this week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report with Paul Gatling, an inspection of what the latest financial indicators tell us about the spring and summer in Arkansas. That's in about 2 minutes on today's Ozarks at Large.
That's legendary bassist Ron Carter from his CD, The Golden Striker. And I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday. We'll hear more from Ron Carter. We'll hear from Matt Wilson and Junior Mance, Grover Washington, Art Pepper, the Ginger Baker Trio, and more. That's on Shades of Jazz. KUAF 91.3 FM, listener-supported National Public Radio.
Heston Kerstad is no longer an Arkansas Razorback. The slugging outfielder was selected by the Baltimore Orioles last night in the first round of the Major League Baseball draft. The Orioles chose him with the second overall selection. Only Jeff King, who was the first overall pick in 1986, has ever been taken higher out of the University of Arkansas. Last night, Kerstad met with press via Zoom after he was taken by the Baltimore Orioles.
You know, I'm just excited to be a part of Birdland now and, you know, embark on my next journey of professional baseball. And, you know, right now I'm just stoked to be a part of the Orioles, and it's a dream come true for me.
Kerstad's last season with Arkansas was cut short when the NCAA halted, then canceled the baseball season in March because of the coronavirus.
I'm Paul Gatling. Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
On the program, a roundup of some of the headlines from the new issue of the magazine, on newsstands and online this week. Plus, we will hear from University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj, who says initial signs of how Arkansas is faring from the COVID-19 pandemic indicate the state was not hit as hard as neighboring states. And burned-out business owners. Why do people who own their own businesses, the American dream for so many, get burned out? Business Journal contributor and Fayetteville entrepreneur Mark Zweig addressed that topic in the latest issue of the Business Journal. That's all ahead after the break on this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security. Member FDIC. Equal Housing Lender.
What does COVID-19 mean for the construction industry? For our cover story in the new issue of the Business Journal, we've got a Q&A with Greg Fogel, who is a chief operating officer for Nabholz. He offers up his perspective on the construction activity level in Northwest Arkansas, the challenges of a shrinking labor market, and just how essential construction is during a public health crisis. We've also got reporting on a patent awarded to Fayetteville startup Linnaeus Medical. Springdale fintech developer Teslar Software helped create a website to help businesses with the Paycheck Protection Program. And Walton Enterprises, that's the holding company owned by heirs of Walmart founders Sam and Helen Walton, completed a land purchase last month that will lead to more parking options in downtown Bentonville. You can find details on those stories and others in the latest issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. The digital version is available for free at nwabusinessjournal.com. Economist Mervin Jebaraj is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. Appearing on a recent episode of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock, he discussed how COVID-19 has impacted the state's economy.
Mervin, let's begin with state revenues. The numbers for the June report, which reflect payrolls in May, sales in April, wasn't as bad as I felt they'd be based on what we've been seeing anecdotally. Overall revenue down 2%. Individual income tax is actually up 1.3% over last year. Sales and use tax is down only 2.8%. Why do you think we stayed as strong as we did?
Right. I think when we originally were making projections in March, when we first closed down a lot of retail establishments, particularly restaurants, bars and hotels and, you know, gyms and salons and those types of businesses, I think we were uncertain about what percentage of people would still go out and shop and engage in daily activities. And I think the difference is that Arkansas never really had a stay-at-home order. And so, you know, people reduced how much they traveled to a lot of different locations, but over time they started coming back out in later March and early April, and over time started spending money again. So I think when you look at sales and use tax in particular for March and for April, both of those were just under about 3% less than where we were last year. So you have to imagine that between last year and this year, we would have probably grown more than we would have collected more sales and use taxes this year compared to last year, just if the economy continued growing as it had been. So a 3% decline is just looking at it as if it were static from last year to this year. So we did lose a little more than that if you account for, you know, in January and February, sales and use taxes in Arkansas were higher than they were in January and February of last year. So at least compared to that trend, the March and April sales and use taxes are not only lower than where they were last year, but probably lower than where they would have been had we not had these closures. But I think what we're seeing from the data, at least in people's mobility, traffic statistics, and consumer spending data that we've seen, is that people sort of started coming back out and spending money right around mid-April when those $1,200 stimulus checks hit households. And so you see an increase, sort of the decline in spending that happened from mid-March all the way through mid-April, kind of turned around almost exactly on the day that the first check started hitting people's bank accounts. So that obviously played a role in getting people back out and spending money in the economy. But where they're spending money is important, and I think it's important to point out that smaller businesses are probably not seeing the benefits of people coming out and participating in the economy. Smaller businesses are not seeing the benefits of people spending those $1,200 checks. By and large, a lot of that, the biggest increase we've seen in consumer spending has been in general merchandise stores, home goods, and furnishing stores. So larger, big box retail that sort of A, has more space. If people want to physically distance, that may be lax in their enforcement of how many people are inside the building, whether or not they're maintaining physical distance. And obviously a lot of bigger box stores are not imposing mask requirements, which is different than smaller businesses like restaurants and bars and those types of establishments where consumers are required to maintain that 6-foot distance and required to wear masks for at least a certain amount of time as they enter and leave the business. So I think those sort of guidelines being different for those types of businesses obviously pushes a lot more business to larger big box stores at the expense of smaller businesses and smaller stores that don't have as much space, don't have as much capacity. And as a result, people are not comfortable going into smaller stores, even though, you know, the difference between small and large stores may not be that big in reality, given that people are not distancing in bigger stores and not wearing masks in bigger stores. Consumers' perceptions might be that bigger stores are safer because there's more space than smaller stores. And so I think it's important that the state provide uniform guidelines to businesses, both large and small, in terms of capacity, in terms of enforcing the physical distance requirement and enforcing mask wearing so that people feel comfortable going to both larger and smaller businesses. And what we're seeing so far is that consumer spending is returning to larger big box stores and not returning to smaller businesses and not returning to restaurants and those types of activities yet.
Jebaraj also noted the state lost about 111,000 jobs in April. The majority of those came from two industries, leisure and hospitality, and, maybe a little surprising, healthcare. There is much more in that interview with Roby Brock, and you can check it out on our sister website at talkbusiness.net. One final note today, I want to direct you to the Business Journal website, where you'll find an opinion piece that's generated quite a bit of social media buzz this week. As we start to poke our heads out of our holes to get this economy restarted, a number of business owners who shut down because of COVID-19 aren't coming back. They are burned out and simply going to shut it down for good. What's the reason? Well, Mark Zweig is a successful business operator of numerous ventures and an executive in residence teaching entrepreneurship in the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. He offers his perspective on business burnout in a guest commentary included in the latest issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. You can also find it online at nwabusinessjournal.com. And that's all for today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report. Remember, you can follow us online. You can also track our reporting on both Facebook and Twitter, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn. You'll find our reporting on all three of those platforms each and every day. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. KUAF is raising money in June to end our financial year strong. We're wanting to raise $35,000 by June 30th, and we can get there with your help. When we reach our goal, we can then unlock an additional $19,000 that's been offered up thanks to many generous KUAF donors. So far, this is as of mid-morning Thursday, according to Sherry Ottaviano, our membership director, we've raised 12,000 $589.11 toward our goal. Your support of KUAF right now will make a real impact. And when we reach $35,000 raised, we can add another $19,000 to that total. Support the vital news, music, and conversations you rely on every day. You can give right now if you're able at supportkuaf.com. And thank you. This is Ozarks at Large. Blake Robertson is retiring as the president of Northwest Technical Institute this week. He took the helm at the Springdale Technical School in the summer of 2014. Prior to that, he was vice president of adult and workforce education at the College of the Ouachitas in Malvern. Today, the institution is called Arkansas State University Three Rivers. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke via Zoom with him to discuss his tenure and his upcoming retirement. During their conversation, Robertson said this isn't the first time he's made retirement plans.
In 2014, I was going to retire. I had put all my papers in, and then I had a friend tell me, by the way, there's a job in Springdale running the career and technical school. And of course, I'd been familiar with the school since about 1974, when I was in the Office of Budget in Finance Administration and worked with the vocational schools. And I had been trying, when I was at Malvern, to bring adult education and vocational together. And it was just very expensive to start up a new vocational school. So adult ed does workforce development, but we just couldn't get the money. I mean, it's millions of dollars to put in a school like we have here. And so then one of my friends up here called and said, you know, there's a job that you might be interested in Springdale. And of course, I lived in Hot Springs. The family was all in Hot Springs. And I said, you know, I've got to apply for that. And so I applied, and the board had several people that they interviewed, and I was fortunate enough to be hired. You know, we are the last career and technical school left in Arkansas. Back in 74, there used to be 24 vocational schools. You could stand at the entrance of one, throw a rock and hit the other one. Yeah, I mean, that's how plentiful they were. And over the 80s and 90s, 90s in particular, they became two-year colleges, and they became branches of four-year schools, U of A, ASU, and then there's a few two-year independent two-year schools left. And so I feel privileged to have run the last career and technical school in Arkansas for 6 years. And we've done a lot of good things.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you about. What goals did you have when you first came to the institution, and have you been able to meet those goals?
The thing I want to do is bring the school up from a vocational school to a really a modern day institution. We did board policy, we did dress code. You know, we did a lot of things that brings prestige to the institution. For years, we were in the Department of Career Education. I lobbied and got put into the Division of Higher Education under the Department of Education. I wanted to expand the offerings. Well, first of all, let me back up. I wanted to make sure that all we did was worthwhile. And so we closed some programs that just didn't attract enrollment. And then we opened programs that people seemed to really want and think it would be very advantageous here at Northwest Arkansas. One of the things I did was start a CDL training program I brought a third-party vendor in. We had a big driving range out there, and the school had decided a year before I got here that the liability was pretty high for the school to operate the program. Very true. When you have a large vehicle out on the road, there's just a lot of liability. And so I knew a third-party vendor that I had worked with at Malvern, and he brought his program up here. And we've operated for the last 6 years. He doesn't have a vacant seat in any of his flights. So, you know, it's a very well needed program. I mean, you've got a lot of industry up here that needs CDL drivers. And so that was the first thing I did when I first got here. And then I knew that we needed more room for our allied health programs. LPN is our largest program. And so I arranged classrooms, and right now the LPN program is over at our Collegiate Center. It's a separate building, and they're one of the few programs in that building. Our Surge Tech program, we put them in a larger space that they can use as an operating room. In fact, I've had each of our programs has an advisory committee that is composed of people in the industry. And so I've had people from that advisory, the Surgical Technology Advisory Committee, say, hey, this is not a bad setup. I mean, this is realistic. And so we put them in a larger space where they weren't kind of on top of each other. And then put them in a larger classroom. Then when I first got here, the finance person said, oh, by the way, you've got $2.6 million set aside as a bequeath. Wow. I mean, who knew? And so we began, the board and I began talking, how would we spend this money? What program would we put this into? And it was determined that welding was going to be our place, our program that we would spend this money. And so we developed plans. I mean, it took a couple of years to get everything together. But we're in the last stage of the building process, and we should have it ready by July. Absolutely ready for next fall. This will increase our welding double. And so we'll have the opportunity to have post-secondary double spaces, secondary welding, you know, the high school. We'll have double in our night program, our night welding program. We have welding going on here about four nights a week. And there's a waiting list to get into these programs. So that was one thing that I wanted to get a handle on, is that money that had been bequeathed to us by the Byrd family. And then later, we were able to secure a Tyson grant, $1 million Tyson grant. And then the governor said, well, if you get the $1 million Tyson grant, I'll put in $1 million. And so we had $2 million, and our ammonia refrigeration and our industrial maintenance programs are top-notch. We're one of four in the nation. And once our 19,000 square foot laboratory is built, and it's started now, so within July and before the fall, we'll have two new buildings. The welding building is about 17,000 square feet. It's going to have three classrooms, office complex, office suite. We'll have a nice large laboratory where we'll do welding and fabrication and, store metals.
Well, you've had a very busy last year of work with the groundbreaking of the welding facility in August, which I understand is the first new building in about 20 years on campus. And then in February, broke ground on the ammonia refrigeration center, which is going to be one of the largest, if not the largest, of its kind.
It'll be the largest in the nation. We'll be one of four nationwide. And actually, we could have people from the globe coming here learning about refrigeration and industrial maintenance.
And if all of that wasn't enough, you got to run an institution in the middle of a pandemic. What was that like at an institution where hands-on is very important for the training and it's not as easy as other institutions to just move classes online?
Right. You know, it's not like we could have a lecture class and all go to an online platform. I was very fortunate. Robin Eason is our vice president of instruction, just a very progressive, hardworking young lady. She really took the bull by the horns, so to speak, and got with each chair. And each program had a online platform that we were able to utilize, either Google Classroom or maybe a unique platform for that particular book. And so for the last several months, we've been doing classroom work, and we installed a deposit box out front. So when the student needed to send material, they could deposit that in the box out front. And then the instructor or the chair would come by and pick it up at the appropriate time. So it's been a real challenge, but everybody has risen to the occasion.
So after moving classroom instruction online for the semester, students have been able to come back in the month of June to complete their laboratory assignments, of course, following guidelines like masks and hand sanitizer and temperature checks. So they'll be able to finish out their time here and be prepared for the workforce.
Right.
You are wrapping things up as well. You're retiring. What's next for you? Yeah. What does retirement look like?
I sent out a farewell letter to the chambers and to the staff saying, this is a time of great financial and stress. And so, I hate not to have some kind of reception where I can thank people for the work and the aid they've given me over the last 6 years. But I just can't. Bring people together. It's such a. Cases are on the rise here. And we've got to be real careful. So anyway, chapter two. I'll be working with our accreditation, nationwide accreditation body, Council on Occupational Education. I have worked with them for the past year. I've taken trips to different schools in the United States. We go in as a team, and usually it's 4 to 5 people that have been skilled in what to look for to be a rigorous, well-run institute. So I've been to a couple of accreditation visits, and I'll do that a little more. I think that'll be just tons of fun. You don't get paid, but you get your travel paid for. And so I thought, that'd be a great way. There's a lot of places in the United States that I haven't seen. And then I've got some opportunities around here for career and technical training. We're going to try to do a machine shop training at some point. I've got some companies that are interested in helping. We need machinists here in Northwest Arkansas and Arkansas. And so I thought, you know, what the heck? I'd give that a shot. And then, of course, my poor wife has been retired for about 7 years. And so, you know, I'll be rejoining her at home. We bought a house about a year ago in Farmington. And so we're going to call this Northwest Arkansas home. So that's kind of what I've got planned.
Well, it sounds like a good retirement. Is there anything else you would like to share with us today?
We've got a great school. I always like to tout, and I'm excited that Jim Rollins will be coming here. I think that'll ramp up our world-classness. So I'm very anxious to see what happens in the next chapter of NWTI. And, you know, I always like to thank the many faculty and staff and community and state leaders who have helped me over the years. You know, I have looked good because they have made me look good. I mean, it's been a team effort. And so that's really kind of the parting thing that I'd like to stress to people is that we've all been a team. We've all done the important things. We've gotten students out in the public, and things are looking good for the future. You know, with the new buildings and the new administration, I'm excited to see what happens.
Well, thank you for your time today, and congratulations on your retirement.
Well, thank you.
That was Blake Robertson, president of Northwest Technical Institute. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda last week. Robertson will retire from NWTI June 13th. Jim Rollins, former superintendent of Springdale Public Schools for nearly 40 years, will take over as the president on July 1st.
Voter registration has fallen during the pandemic, but organizers are trying to channel some of the energy from anti-racism protests to convince a younger, more diverse group of Americans to vote.
Have you ever had a soda bottle and they shake that thing and shake that thing, and after a while when you try to take that top off and it explodes? That's the processes. That's where we are right now.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3. And tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Washington County has flipped the switch on the largest solar array in the state, plus a 100-year-old gypsy camp on the banks of the Illinois River being restored. We'll also look back at the week's news with Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics, and look forward to what's ahead in entertainment, even if just virtually, with Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. A Friday, Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m., on 91.3 KUAF.
Walmart Museum presents live at the Five and Dime virtual concert series every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on Facebook. This series is a collaboration with University of Arkansas Department of Music and Downtown Bentonville Incorporated. More information available at walmartmuseum.com under events.
This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas may be moving to phase two of its reopening, but the COO and administrator of the Washington Regional Medical System has released a statement calling the rapid rise of coronavirus cases in Northwest Arkansas a serious public health emergency. Birch Wright says on May 12th, there were 4 COVID-19 positive patients hospitalized in Northwest Arkansas hospitals. But hospitalizations have doubled every week, and now there are more than 70 COVID-19 positive patients in area hospitals. Washington Regional has also seen more critically ill patients, with over 30% of those who are hospitalized requiring ventilator support. He also states the rise in hospitalizations is not related to more testing. He attributes the rise to more people in the area becoming infected. To address the rapid spread of COVID-19, Washington Regional is opening a second inpatient unit to care for suspected and confirmed COVID-19 patients, which means they can now treat 38 inpatients with the ability to expand as necessary. Wright says they've also reopened their coronavirus clinic on North Hills Boulevard in Fayetteville to address the increased demand for screening and testing. He also says Washington Regional is prepared for this surge, saying their team has the staff, supplies, and resources necessary to effectively respond to local coronavirus cases while continuing their normal healthcare operations. Finally, Wright says it's of great importance that the community take the recent surge in COVID-19 cases seriously. That clinic, by the way, is at 3318 North Hills Boulevard in Fayetteville. It's dedicated to COVID-19 screening and testing of individuals who do not have symptoms, but who may have had a direct exposure to someone who is positive. More information available at 463-2055.
Welcome to 60 Second Civics, the daily podcast of the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. Many states resisted the Supreme Court's order in 1954 to integrate their schools. As late as 1957, the governor of Arkansas tried to stop black students from entering a white high school in Little Rock. In response, President Dwight Eisenhower ordered federal troops to escort the students and enforce the law. The civil rights movement started in the 1950s. It was a time when many people worked to end unfair treatment by government. People marched in the streets, wrote letters to Congress asking for stronger laws, and held boycotts. One of the earliest boycotts began in 1955. Rosa Parks was a working woman who lived in Montgomery, Alabama. She was on her way home one day when the bus she was riding in became crowded. Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man. She was arrested for violating a city law. The African-American community boycotted the city buses until the city changed the law. That's all for today's podcast, 60 Second Civics, where civic education only takes a minute.
The theme to 60 Second Civics, written and performed by Cheryl B. Engelhart. You can find her online at cbemusic.com. That song is titled Complacent. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Spring Valley. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Antoinette Grajeda and Anna Stitt. Our show mastered by Timothy Dennis. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling and Roby Brock, part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Additional assistance with this evening's show provided by Michael Hiblin with KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock. Our theme written and performed by Daryl Sean. We're back with a new show tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. Thanks for listening.